Welcome to Rehash.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Rehash, a Web3 podcast. I'm your host, Diana Chen. And today we're speaking with Cami Ramos, head of DevRel at Fuel Labs, an early contributor of DeveloperDAO and the creator of Women Build Web3, all about account abstraction, talent DAOs, and some of the social implications of crypto. DeveloperDAO is a community of thousands of Web3 builders who help onboard devs to Web3 and build Web3 tools and public goods. And Women Build Web3 is a spinoff of DeveloperDAO that's solely focused on funding women and non-binary engineers. Cami was nominated by David Phelps and voted onto the podcast by Paris Rosati, Scott Moore, Dina Burke, Aaron Soskin, Denison Bertram, Christina Beltramini, Triumph, David Phelps, and myself. Before we dive into our conversation, here's a quick word from the Web3 projects that helped make the season possible.
Social media wasn't designed for ads and algorithms. It was made for people. And at Lens Protocol, we're putting people back in control. We're not looking for users' data. We're here to build a community of collaborators. Builders, artists, and dreamers ready to unlock a new world of social media. This isn't just an app. It's a flourishing ecosystem of platforms and experiences owned and operated by the developers and creators who are bringing it to life. In the Lensverse, you don't just own your content. You own everything. Your data, your connections, the value you bring to the table, it all stays in your possession, exactly where it should be. As a creator, the Lens ecosystem offers a new set of tools for connecting with your audience. Your data is truly portable and belongs to you. Post once and distribute everywhere in the Lensverse. You can even take your followers with you from app to app. As a developer, you can skip right past building the base layers and scaling your users by plugging your new app directly into Lens's existing infrastructure and community. So whether you create with a brush or a camera, sound waves or lines of code, it's time you got your due. Come create the future of social media with us on Lens Protocol. Lens is the last social media handle you'll ever need.
Have you seen how epic Ambire Wallet is?
How epic it is?
Yeah. Cue the music. Ambire is a Web3 wallet that makes crypto self-custody easy and secure for everyone. Instead of relying on clunky seed phrases, you can create an account with the hardware wallet or username and password, secure it with two-factor authentication, and regain access with Ambire's cloud recovery. Need to pay out some contributors or execute a bunch of trades? No problem, Chief. Queue up as many transactions as you want, and when you're ready, execute the entire batch at the same time, paying gas only once. You can even prepay for gas with stablecoins or Ambire's native wallet token, which will get you some cash back. Without ever leaving the Ambire interface, you can manage assets from over a dozen chains, safely migrate them with Ambire's built-in bridge, and seamlessly interact with dApps like Uniswap, Aave, and Snapshot, all within the same transaction. Plus, Ambire is constantly growing their dApp catalog with trusted partners and collaborating with builders who want to establish the new standard for smart contract wallets. So, pretty epic, huh?
Yeah, I already knew all that though. I've had an Ambire wallet for months.
And you didn't tell me?
You never asked.
To get involved and truly own your assets, go to ambire.com. How was your day?
Bad.
What happened?
I bought some NFTs and then they just disappeared.
Sounds like your NFT creator should have used NFT.storage.
NFT dot what?
NFT.storage. Come on, I'll show you. With NFT.storage, anyone can easily upload their NFT data to a decentralized and reliable storage network completely for free.
Wow, how does it work?
Well, instead of relying on centralized and impermanent storage solutions, NFT.storage uploads your files to IPFS and Filecoin. These are powerful peer-to-peer networks that are made for the decentralized web. Thanks to IPFS's unique storage system, you can be confident that once your files are uploaded, they'll be accessible from anywhere in the world for as long as you'd like. They're already trusted by some of the biggest names in Web3, like OpenSea, Magic Eden, and Rarible. By adding files to these networks for free, NFT.storage is helping to turn proper NFT data management into a public good. This will ensure that NFTs will remain accessible and secure in the long run, so you won't get rugged again.
Gee, so I just upload my files and NFT.storage will take care of the rest?
Now you're getting it!
Go to nft.storage today to upload some NFT data of your own for free. And be sure to follow nft.storage on Twitter at nftdotstorage.
So without further ado, here's our guest, Cammie. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Hey, Diana. Thanks so much for having me. Thanks so much for the nomination, David, and everyone voting. It was a really fun experience to participate in that. Although I'm a huge supporter of Joke DAO, I've only been involved in a very small amount of contests, so that was really fun. Thanks a lot for having me.
Of course, and you'll be able to use Joke DAO more next season as you'll have nomination and voting rights after being a guest on this podcast, and so you'll be able to help us decide next season's guests using Joke DAO. So I'm really excited for you to experience that too for the first time.
Amazing.
The first thing I want to talk to you about is your role as the head of DevRel, developer relations, or DevRel, is still kind of a newish role that a lot of non-technical newcomers to Web3 still don't fully understand. Could you start by just explaining what developer relations is and what a head of DevRel does?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of different definitions because it is a very new role and it's very fluid and it kind of adapts to the needs of the organization. But I think generally the role of developer relations tends to be in a company that's building something for developers, whether it be tooling, language, infrastructure. So it's something that's developer facing. And the role of developer relations is everything around adoption and growth of the product. So that's kind of the end goal. And the way that you get there can look different depending on where you're at, depending on what you're good at. So some kind of typical things that you'll see are things like doing conference talks and workshops, doing a lot of educational things at a lot of orgs. That's also the team in charge of docs and kind of everything external facing for documentation for developers, everything around partnerships. Even at some orgs, it kind of encompasses partnerships. But I think generally it's just leveraging your relationships and your network and kind of your reputation to say, hey, I think this is a really cool project and I'm going to make it easier for other developers to understand its value and understand how to use it.
So is somebody in this DevRel role somebody who's a technical person? Do you have to understand how to code and things like that yourself, or can non-technical people also be in this role?
Yes, this is a question that's been asked a lot kind of in this space. And, you know, there's both sides of the coin and, you know, different people kind of land on the spectrum in a different place. My personal opinion is that it just depends on the product. If you're working with something that's very abstract and like very far away from having to know the ins and outs of how something works, then I think it's fine to have someone that's not technical and someone who's more focused on growth and adoption. But if you're working with a product that is lower level or lower in the stack, then I think you do need to have someone technical. So let's say something like Fleek, for example. Fleek is a platform for you to deploy. It's like hosting, Web3 hosting. So for example, as a developer, you know, you don't really have to know how hosting works. You just want to click a button and host your website. So for a product like that, you know, if I were in charge of hiring, I would be more focused on finding someone who's really good at growing communities, who's really good at getting the word out there. Whereas if I was the leader of a project that was very technical and developers, like something like Fuel, for example, where there's a new programming language, there's a new blockchain, there's a bunch of new SDKs, you'd probably do need someone technical to fill that role. So again, I think it just depends on the product.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. One question we had from Louis from our community is, how do you see the DevRel role evolving with Web3? Are there any new practices and tools compared to being a DevRel in traditional tech, or any new responsibilities?
I would say the biggest difference and kind of the biggest change as someone who's done DevRel in both Web 2 and in Web 3 is the sheer amount of hands-on community management that is involved. I think in Web 2, the DevRel role is a lot more focused on kind of the function of developer relations, so like writing docs, attending conferences, you know, writing tutorials. But in Web 3, not just for DevRel, but in general, the industry is very community-focused. Everyone is in like 100 group chats. Everyone is in 100 Discord servers. Everyone is active on Twitter. So when you're doing DevRel, you kind of act as the face of your community. You act as the face of your project. So there's a lot more that goes into managing those relationships day to day. You know, for me, it's really hard to keep up with the amount of messages because there's just way too many across platforms. So I think that's the biggest difference. And then in terms of maybe like tooling or the function, or how I see it evolving with Web3, I think for the most part, it's pretty much the same. I think there's just a way bigger emphasis on you as a community leader in Web3 rather in Web2. It's kind of just like, we just need someone to write docs. We just need someone to like do something. Whereas in Web3, I think it's a lot more focused on like, who are you as a person and what does the community perceive of you? And do we want that associated with our project?
Gotcha, gotcha. It almost feels like a more well-rounded kind of job description in Web3 than in Web2, where Web2 is like anybody that can write technical docs can kind of do this job. But in Web3, it's more about like, you know, your personality matters and your ability to go up and speak at conferences matters and your ability to talk to people and communicate effectively about technical concepts. All of that is important as well.
Exactly.
So in addition to holding this head of DevRel role at Fuel and at previous companies that you've been at, you're also involved in talent DAOs on the side. And one DAO that you were an early contributor to and very involved in was Developer DAO. And then you also spun out Women Build Web 3 from Developer DAO that's just focused on female engineers. When it comes to talent DAOs, from what you've seen, in what ways are talent DAOs better than, you know, traditional job boards like Indeed or even headhunters when it comes to seeking out DevRel or technical roles?
Yeah, I think there's a ton of merit in talent DAO specifically for that. And that's actually, that was the main purpose of Women Build Web 3. So we spun out because I saw a need for, one, for a community of kind of more intermediate to advanced level women and non-binary engineers. This was in 2021, kind of like peak bull market, peak, like a bunch of people coming into the space. And there were a lot of DAOs and communities focused on women that were coming out, which is great. But what I noticed is that all of them were very focused on beginner, like onboarding 101. What is blockchain? What is a wallet? Like, what are smart contracts? And I didn't really see a place for people like me, for women like me, who are already engineers, who are already professionals, who wanted that space in that community to find kind of other, you know, people at that level to work on projects. And initially my vision was like, it's like, if you want to have a, you know, a woman CTO or a woman partner or a woman like co-founder, this is going to be the community where you would find it. And the way that we did it was 100% focused on contributions and on building. So we didn't focus too much on, I would say, maybe more community stuff, like going to conferences and sponsoring, you know, scholarships and doing what a lot of the other DAOs at the time were doing. But we were really focused on shipping. And the idea was that if we build a bunch of stuff and everyone here gets experience, everyone will be able to level up and get that job that they wanted because they'll be able to see their contributions and say, look, I built this as a freelancer. I built this through this community and now I've leveled up and I've gotten this kind of like recognition from my community and the connections that come with it. So I think back to your question, like why it's better than maybe headhunters or traditional recruiting is because when you have this network of verification that says, yes, I worked with this person and they're really good. But more than that, you are kind of part of this even wider network, this wider community that even people who aren't part of Women Build Web 3 have seen the work that we've done. For example, we built 30 days of Web3.xyz, which is a page where people can go on and learn how to build full stack applications on Ethereum for free. It's like, you know, hours and hours of curriculum. We had a Discord server with like office hours and live support. And not only did we build all the curriculum for it, but we built the core application and we built everything, all the infrastructure. So we built our website, we built the curriculum hosting website, we built everything. And through that, even people who weren't in the DAO were able to see like, oh, this X person is really good. Like they built this thing and now I can recommend them for a role or I can give them some sort of reference. Whereas with traditional recruiting and headhunting, you don't really have that. And it relies a lot more on these formal systems of, you know, what university did you go to? How did you do in your interview? You know, who was your last employer? It's not very based on like the actual value of your contributions, but more on, I don't know, pedigree and like traditional kind of like values, I would say.
Yeah, for sure. I think the incentives are also much different with headhunters than with a group like Women Build Web 3, where in Women Build Web 3, you have a group of women who are all builders and who all want to see each other succeed and help each other. And I'm sure once some of these people work together on a project, they're like, oh, wow, like Cammy, we work really well together. Like maybe we want to start a project together. Like maybe I have an idea for a cool project and you want to build that with me and we'll do that together. Or somebody can come in and like you said, you know, like find a female co-founder or CTO for their project and already see the work that they've done, which I think the incentives there are so much better aligned than if you go to a headhunter and they're just, you know, trying to get you hired somewhere so that they can get paid out for their work and they don't really care. You know, it's like once you get hired out, like that's it. Like, I don't have to ever talk to you again. Like, I don't really care about, you know, whether you find necessarily the best fit or not.
Totally. Yeah. And like a ton of the cohort of Women Build Web3 have gone on to find jobs and kind of like we've achieved our goal. I 100% feel that way. Initially, when we started, the goal was like everyone's going to level up, whether that means you getting your first job in Web3 or you're getting a better job in Web3 or you want to be a freelancer, whatever that means. So when we first started the cohort, I think there were only three of us who were already working full time in Web3. It was me and two other people. Now, more than like 60-70% of us work in Web3 full time. And it was through that work. And specifically what you said, where you're like, you know, we work really well together. Maybe we should work together in the future. That happened with Sarah. So Sarah Schwartz is now on my team at Fuel Labs. And, you know, I hired her because we worked together for 6 months at Women Build Web3. And I saw how dank of an engineer she was. And I was like, if I'm building a team, I want Sarah on it. And tons of other people in Women Build Web3 I felt that way about. And I even tried to hire them. If for one reason or another, it just didn't work out. But that thesis played out right in front of our eyes where a ton of people were like, you know, if I'm building out a dream team, I know who I want on it because I've had this experience of working with you all.
Yeah, that's super awesome to hear. I know too, just from talking to you in the past, that something you're passionate about is not just community building, but is uniting people from all over the world. And I know you did a lot of this work back when you were at The Graph as well. And I'm just curious to hear from your perspective, what are some of the best pieces of advice you have for community builders listening to this podcast on how they can go about building a global contributor base?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things to consider. The main one is just like one, being super conscious and mindful about every decision that you make. And like one, I think is probably taking a step back and doing research and kind of understanding the different characteristics of different regions. I remember when we were on a panel together at Graph Day, that was one thing I talked about where it was like, you know, if you're hosting an event, for example, and you need to stake, I don't know, half an ether to attend, you know, thinking about people in other regions, for example, who might not have access to the proper on and off ramps to be able to even have access to Ether, who might not have $1,000 in Ether to stake and just be like, oh yeah, I'll just get it back in a month. So those types of decisions, like in the beginning, they seem, you know, not important and kind of trivial. But as you start thinking more globally and start thinking about different regions, you really have to be mindful of those things. And number two, you know, a big piece of advice and one big thing that I've learned in DevRel is that it's virtually impossible to grow a community on your own. You know, you can do a good job of starting it and planting the seed, but that's just not how a community works. A community can't be based off one person or a couple people. So one thing that I always aim to do, especially in roles like head of developer relations, is develop these many-to-many relationships. So instead of me having to, let's say, have a one-to-many relationship where I'm the core connection and everyone has to come to me and ask me stuff and ask me what I think, instead, I try to empower people in different regions to be that person for their region, and you can scale a lot faster with that. So for example, at Fuel, we have an ambassador program, and then we also have a different program that's run by the DevRel organization where we partner with different developer communities, and they're pretty much free to do whatever they want, you know, obviously within some boundaries and goals, right? But for example, in Medellin, I met this community when I came here initially to visit, and they were super awesome. And we gave them a small grant to start hosting weekly Fuel sessions where it was like 10, 20 engineers were getting together and were really excited about modular. And after a month and a half, they hosted their own hackathon completely autonomously from me. I had nothing to do with it. I wasn't even there. I never attended any of the weekly sessions either. And they got like 40 hackers together to build on Fuel, and it was 100% autonomous. And then from that, the Fuel community in Mexico saw that and they're like, we should do a hackathon here too. So they basically like start to sprout all these different communities with no intervention from me or anyone from the Fuel team. So when you're thinking about growing a global community, I think that's the thing to consider is like, you're not going to be able to grow a community everywhere. So you should just empower leaders and key people in different regions and be like, here, here's the support that you need. Here are the resources that you need. Like, just do you.
So when you say empower other people, do you give them, you know, like a whole toolkit of resources that they can use? Or is it more about, you know, kind of just like the mental support, the kind of like emotional support of saying, hey, you know, Cammy, like, you're a great leader. You can go out and do this on your own. Like, you can start a hackathon for people in your community. Like, which one is that? And if there's, you know, tangible resources you give people in like a toolkit, is that just something that you put together yourself? Or is there like a website that you can direct people to? Anyone listening who is like, wow, this sounds cool. Like, I wonder if I could put on something like this.
Yeah. So we don't really put together anything specific. It's basically just like all the documentation and all the resources that are already existing. The main piece that of support that we give is we support financially. So we give them a small grant to cover expenses, to pay their team, to kind of not have that be a worry. And then also we have, for example, in Latin America, we have a Telegram channel called Fuel en Español, and it's where all of the Fuel community that's Spanish speaking lives. And that piece right there, I think, is really important because you're able to chat and connect with people from different parts of the region. And again, not having to rely on me being like, hey, do you think I should do this? Do you think this is a good idea? Instead, you can just like kind of consult this group of people who are all, you know, incentive aligned and excited and whatever about the project. So I'd say that, yeah, like the biggest pieces really are like financial support and then giving them the tools and the community to be able to bounce ideas off and actually execute.
Yeah. So I know recently that you actually made a pretty big move, like physically you moved from the US to Colombia. And a lot of that was fueled by this kind of thesis that you have that you wrote about in an article back in, I think, sometime in the fall of last year about emerging regions like LATAM countries that you believe should be the focus of crypto innovation and growth rather than North America and like European regions. So I want to get into this much more deeply, but just to sort of provide some context for listeners who aren't as familiar with LATAM, what are some of the political and social events that have taken place in LATAM countries like Colombia, Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, etc., in recent years that have affected the country's local currencies and the way that people kind of like view money and transact money?
Yeah, wow. There's so much to say on this topic. There's literally too much to say on this topic. I'll just say generally, there's a lot of political and economic instability in these regions, and in large part due to, you know, U.S. intervention. And that's a whole thing we can get into later. And, you know, there's people who are like, no, they're just criminals, or no, they're just this, or no, the president is just dumb. But when you look at what's actually happening in a lot of these places, namely like Venezuela and Colombia, you see that there actually has a lot to do with U.S. intervention and U.S. interests and how they find their way into these countries and displace governments, install their own governments, take over power. But generally, all of these things is to say, like, there's a lot of economic and political instability, and that leads to, you know, fear, people being fearful. And, you know, that leads to things that we see every day here, like bank runs, people not trusting banks, people keeping money, you know, in their house, people keeping cash, banks actually not having money, and just currency devaluation. So all across the region, currency devaluation has hit record highs in the last, I don't know, 6 months. In different places, there's been elections. So like Brazil, Colombia, there's been pretty historic elections that have also brought a lot of fear. For example, Colombia just elected its first like super leftist president and its first Black woman vice president. They're both super leftist. It hasn't happened in the country, you know, in a long time, and especially not this, I would say, extreme, or, you know, at least perceived to be this extreme. And there's a lot of fear that comes with that. Same thing in Brazil. They had a really, just subjectively, right? Like, to me, they had a really crazy president who was doing a bunch of fucked up shit. And that was also leading to a bunch of problems within the region. And all of these things are one of the core reasons why I think LATAM is perfectly situated for innovation. Because I really think that innovation comes from necessity, that people come up with cool stuff because they're solving a problem. They're trying to get to a solution. And that's where innovation comes in. And when you think of the global West, when you think of the US, when you think of Europe, 99.9% of residents in these places have their financial needs met. You can open a bank account. You have access to financial services. Even, you know, people who are traditionally disenfranchised, like when you think about immigrants, undocumented people, African Americans, like they still have access to banking. All is fucked up, right? America's fucked up. America sucks. Like they do redlining. They give shitty loans to Black people. They don't even give loans to Black people. Like there's a lot to be said there, but just generally the kind of baseline is we all have access. But then when you go to other countries, that baseline isn't even there. Like, you can't even, like, in Argentina, it's illegal to have U.S. dollars. So there's a black market for U.S. dollars, for example. In Colombia and in tons of other countries, there's tons and tons of people that are literally unbanked. Like, they don't have a bank account. They're not even registered in the country. Like, they're migrants, people fleeing Venezuela, for example. There's a lot of Venezuelans in Colombia because of the crisis there. Tons of people here who don't have access to basic financial services. And I think, you know, obviously that's kind of crypto's main use case and where crypto really shines. So focusing on our energy, our attention, our capital into these regions where we can solve real problems, I think is where that innovation is going to come from.
Yeah, I really like this line that you had in your article that you said necessity breeds innovation. And you kind of just gave some examples of what you mean by that. And there were some other examples in your article too about, I think, some regions in Latin American countries where the closest ATM is like an hour and a half away. And so if you travel there and you forgot to stop in the major city and take out some cash, and all the businesses operate on a cash-only basis, then you're kind of left in the dust there. Some other examples, like, could you share some of those examples for people who maybe haven't read your article yet and talk more about this idea that necessity breeds innovation, and that's sort of why we should be focusing more of our attention on emerging regions that have more of a need for crypto than maybe, you know, places in North America or Europe?
Yeah, I think another one of the examples that I gave was around peer-to-peer crypto usage in Latin America. It's already extremely high, and like higher than European countries, higher than the US. Specifically, I think it was in Argentina and Venezuela, and I think maybe Brazil was up there too. And, you know, when I was looking at this and analyzing it, it just shows that people are already using crypto. People are already transacting with crypto at a much higher rate than we are here in the States. Like, when you think of people in crypto like us, like, who are kind of, I would say, like, the, I don't know, crypto Twitter community, like people who are very active, people who are very much so, like, you know, growing the community, how often do we transact in crypto? Like, people transact in crypto to buy more Ether, to purchase, you know, some asset, like whether it be an NFT or some token, or to sell some asset. That's it. Like, very few people are actually peer-to-peer sending crypto to each other to pay for things, to, you know, purchase things from each other. It just doesn't happen because we don't have that need. Like, we have traditional routes that offer higher security, faster operational speed, more comfort, or whatever the case may be. Like, even if you're in crypto, I guarantee most people still use Venmo on a, you know, semi-regular basis, still are using things like Zelle, still are using things like bank transfers, mostly because, right, like, just the infra isn't there yet. Like, we're not ready for mass adoption, right? So it makes it hard to actually transact in crypto. But even with that, you know, given, countries in Latin America are already transacting in crypto because they have a necessity. They don't have another way to do this. They don't have another way to store value in a way that's less volatile than their local currency. So that's one example. Another one, so San Andres is a very touristy island in Colombia, but obviously there's locals that live there. And on the island, it's a relatively small island. There's one, like a MoneyGram type of place where you can send money, where you can walk in with cash, give them the cash and send it to someone else in the country or abroad. And when I went, there was like this crazy line literally going around the corner of the building of people standing to do that. Same thing even here in the city in Medellin. Like, you walk into one of these places and there's always a line. And it's like, you know, people have this need that's not getting met. Well, it is getting met in a really, like, it's a really bad experience, but people are still doing it because it's their only option. So if it's like you have to stand in line for an hour and a half, 2 hours, pay 5% of the money that you're sending and wait like 3 to 5 business days for the recipient to receive it, obviously there's some opportunity for crypto to provide a better alternative there.
So practically speaking then, what does this mean for people like us that are building in Web3? What types of things should we be building? And I'm curious too to hear, because I know you're really involved in hackathons and the builder community, like, what are some trends that you're seeing people build for today? And do you think those trends are the trends we should be seeing? Like, do you think people are focused on the right things? Or do you think that what we're seeing is just sort of these, like, North Americans and Europeans building for other North Americans and Europeans and not for the rest of the world?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, obviously, I'm not at every hackathon and I'm not in the know of everything that everyone is building. Generally, I think there's still a really big focus on infrastructure, which is good and necessary because we'll never, right, like be able to get to consumer stuff unless the infrastructure is there. But I do wish that there were more people and more teams in, you know, North America and Europe thinking about these types of things. Because, for example, if you go to a hackathon in Latin America, just kind of by default, people are building for real use cases. Like no one's like, okay, obviously this is a generalization and exaggeration, but no one's like, I'm going to build an NFT collection. I'm going to do an NFT marketplace. Because that's just, and you go to a hackathon, you know, in North America, Europe, like someone's always doing something with NFTs. Someone's always doing kind of some, one of the standard projects, which is fine, right? Like not to knock on them, but I'm just saying, I wish I would see more people here kind of thinking of not even necessarily these regions, but just thinking of actual use cases that could be beneficial and offer a better alternative to the incumbent solutions that we have now. So all in all, like, you know, I think what people are building is, you know, generally like good and necessary. And I think with time, hopefully more people will start to see that, you know, there's this area that's wide open, this lane that no one's really in, but it's the lane that's going to have the biggest impact, which is building for consumers, building for everyday people.
Yeah. And I think one thing I really like that you talked about in your article too, is like the biggest need is kind of just like, how can we use crypto for payments? How can we onboard people to crypto and help people use crypto to transact and to do things that they need to do on a daily basis? Not how do we build more complicated DeFi applications, you know? And I'm sure the people that are trying to transact on a basic day-to-day level aren't, you know, out there researching about yield farming or about staking or anything like that. Like they just want to know how they can survive.
Exactly. Exactly. And they just want to like get loans at reasonable interest rates. For example, like right now, my friend, he lives in Guatemala, I think I want to say somewhere in Latin America. And he was just tweeting about how he was going to use DeFi to take out a car, Marcus, to take out a car loan because in, okay, I honestly don't remember. I think it's Guatemala. The interest rates are so incredibly high. It's like 17%, which is like extremely high. It's almost like a credit card for a car loan. So yeah, like there's people who they're like, the thing is the DeFi infrastructure is there. There just isn't the, like all the other pieces that are needed for kind of regular people to leverage DeFi in a way that makes sense while minimizing risk, right? We still see, you know, just at the basic infrastructure blockchain level, like we don't have any true rollups, you know, you're running a risk, although, you know, maybe the risk is relatively low because maybe it's, I don't know, a 7 out of 9 multi-sig signer. At the end of the day, it's still a multi-sig. It's controlled by some team. Or when you think about fraud proofs, it's like, okay, it's fraud provable, but only by, you know, this select group of people. So I wouldn't say that the infrastructure is there for people to actually be trusting and putting, you know, in some cases they're, you know, a big chunk of their money or their life savings to do these types of things. It's just not there yet. But there are people out there like Marcus who's experimenting and who are trying to figure out and kind of trailblaze how to make these experiences better for, you know, everyday people.
Okay, so what's the call to action for different groups of people listening? For devs, for VCs, for marketers, for anybody working on Web3, what's the call to action? What are tangible things they can do to actually like affect change?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that you can do, but I would say the starting point is just like go visit some of these places. You know, instead of going to like the same old conferences and going to Europe every summer and doing ECC and like you've done it a million times, I would say trade that for a different conference, like go to Latin America and just see what life is like, see what kind of people, you know, what kind of problems people are having, what kind of solutions they're building for them, and just do research. And by having that like empathetic perspective, I think you'll be able to unlock and see a bunch of things that you maybe didn't see before.
I love that. All right. Last thing I want to talk to you about, Cami, before I let you go is something that people have been talking about a lot lately. And this is account abstraction. And I think it's a more technical concept that a lot of non-technical people glaze over and maybe feel a little left out when everybody's talking about it on Twitter. I know this is something that you have written about, you've tweeted about, and you do a really good job explaining. So what is account abstraction? Just like the high level Eli 5 for non-technical people.
Account abstraction is programmable transaction validity. That's all it is. So it's the ability for you as a developer to programmatically say what makes a transaction valid. So kind of what that means is, for example, right now on Ethereum, a transaction is valid if and only if the following things are true. The nonce is correct. There's a digital signature and, you know, enough ether has been sent for gas. Those are the only things that make a transaction valid. And account abstraction says, What if you could authorize or, you know, make a transaction valid with anything else? So that could be something like a transaction is valid if and only if, let's say all those things are true. And additionally, instead of just having one signature, you need two signatures. Or if, you know, in addition to paying gas, you must also send in like, you know, one ether. So it's letting you as a developer have more granular control over what makes a transaction valid. And that opens up the door for a lot of the things that we always hear associated with account abstraction, right? We always hear things about better UX. We always hear things about native multisigs. And at a high level, that is what enables it. So a native multisig, for example, is this concept of a wallet where you can put all of your tokens, all of your assets in it and spend directly from there. And how that's different is, for example, usually if you want to interact with a multisig, you have to do it from your personal wallet and then send Ether to authorize a transaction from the multisig. So account abstraction says like, hey, we're going to authorize these types of transactions where you don't need to, for example, authorize from a different wallet, where you can authorize from here. And you can put all of your assets in here and pay gas directly from here.
Gotcha. And what this results in for the average user is just a better user experience across the board. Users will be able to do more things like interact with multisigs in an easier way. They'll maybe be able to like sign transactions more fluidly, things like that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it allows you to have to use different signature schemes. It allows you to use different wallets. Like in theory, it could let you use, let's say, a Solana wallet to sign a transaction on Ethereum or vice versa. And it just gives you a lot more flexibility and, yeah, opens up the door for a lot better experience as a user.
Gotcha. So where are we with account abstraction today? Like how far are we away from being able to do some of the things that you listed?
We're far, but close at the same time. It's complicated. I think in the Ethereum world, like in the EVM world, we're close, but far. Like 4337 contract was deployed and it like opened up the door for, you know, some of these things. But the problem with that is that you need to wait for all these smart contracts to be adapted, the wallets to adapt. Like it needs time for the ecosystem to kind of mature around this. There's other ecosystems like Fuel that have a different implementation of account abstraction because, you know, Fuel is an EVM. There's just a different implementation. Whereas at Fuel, like it's a lot more clear cut. Like account abstraction is live today. It's been live from the beginning and you don't need to wait for wallets or, you know, other people to catch up. You can just use it right out of the box. So I think it just depends like what ecosystem you're in and, you know, where you want to build. But all in all, I say we're still, you know, a little ways away, like not too far, but like not that close either.
Yeah. What are you most excited to see built or just happen in the space in the rest of this year?
I really honestly am excited to see like teams who are focusing on consumer. Sadly, I don't think that'll happen this year just because the market is so bad and the lack of clarity with regulation, I think also is like impeding a lot of that work. But I'm just excited to see more of these protocols mature. You know, I'm now going into my second year of being in crypto full time. And just in this short amount of time, I've seen how much these protocols have progressed. And when I joined, there was very, very little educational material, very, very low standard for docs and experience. And like just things working, like things just didn't work that well a year and a half ago. And now like we're seeing a really, you know, heightened level of maturity. So I'm kind of just excited to see in 6 months from now, at the end of this year, how much better the experience is going to be for developers. And that'll, you know, enable new developers to join the space, more power here for building, and it'll lead to more applications, better experiences, et cetera.
Yeah, I'm hopeful as well. But like you said, with the markets, how they are, you know, consumer isn't necessarily top of mind for some people. All right. So wrapping up, we've got some additional questions from the community, from Twitter and Discord. First question is from David Phelps. He wants to know, reggaeton or salsa?
Reggaeton, always. Yeah. Like, I love salsa, but I just always prefer a little bit of perreo, you know?
Yeah, I got you. Nelson wants to know, salsa or hummus? I think he took a little play on words and saw the salsa and turned it into something else. And I know he's a hummus maxi, so that's probably where that came from.
Okay. Sadly, salsa, but I got hip to hummus very recently. Like, you know, obviously I always knew what hummus was. I imagine I tried it once or twice in the past, but very recently, like I tried it and it was good. And I was like, damn, hummus has been good this whole time. Like I just didn't know, but salsa just cause it's, you know, it's been around and I love her, but hummus, I'm down for hummus too.
Yeah. Have you tried different flavors of hummus? Or just like the traditional classic?
I've just tried traditional hummus.
There's a lot you can do to spice up hummus.
I didn't even know
too.
There were flavors.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can find some like spicier versions, some all different kinds of hummus. So got to get on that.
Okay, putting it on my to-do list.
Very important. And then last one from the community, Triumph wants to know, who is your favorite Bay Area rapper?
The Jacka.
Ah, you had that one ready. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay, so last thing we do, we wrap up with a quick little game. It's a rapid fire game, word association, super easy. Basically, what I'm going to do is I've got this tin of about 50 slips of paper in here, and there is a word on each of these slips of paper. These words are commonly overused or misused words in Web3. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw 10 of these slips of paper. And I'm going to read the word that's on the piece of paper, and you're going to say the first word that comes to mind when you hear the word that I say. The only rules are you can't say the same word I said, and you can't just like say the same word for all 10. Make sense?
Okay, I can do that.
Okay, mm-hmm. So first one. Layer one.
The first thing I thought it was blockchains, but I don't think that's interesting.
You can say that.
I just say any word that comes
any
to
word.
Mind.
It, okay. Yeah, it doesn't even have to make sense. Okay.
Okay.
Second one, exclusivity.
Fake bougie.
Ownership.
Creator economy.
Creator.
Economy.
Ownership economy.
NFTs.
Substrate.
Polka dot.
Moat.
Data.
Meta governance.
I don't know. DAOs.
Governance.
DAOs. Can I say DAOs?
No,
again?
You can't say it again.
Okay. A governance. I don't know. Voting tokens.
Okay. Then last one, privacy.
Manta Network.
I don't even know what
Shout
that
out
is.
To Manta. They're building a lot of cool stuff. Honestly, I vibed with them super well back in Berlin and big fan of what they're building. So yeah, if you're into privacy and ZK stuff, check out Manta.
Cool. Have to check it out. Do you have any final thoughts that you want to share with our listeners before we let you go?
No, just thanks again for having me and excited to pick the next round.
Cool. And then last thing, tell people where they can find you if they want to follow you or if they have a question for you or just kind of want to, you know, keep up with your journey.
Yeah, the best place is Twitter and maybe at this point Blue Sky. Twitter's going to die soon. My handle is the same everywhere. It's Cammy in this thing with an A. So Cammy in this regular spelling and then thang with an A.
Nice. We'll include it in the show notes too to make it easy for people to click through to it. Thank you so much, Cammy, for taking the time to come on today. Excited to see who you pick for next season's guests. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in as always. And we'll be back again next Thursday with another episode of Rehash.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Rehash. Rehash is hosted by Diana Chen, produced and edited by Ellie Dots and Tyler Internet, and sponsored by Lens, Ampire Wallet, and NFT.storage. Rehash is also supported by Rehash DAO, a community of NFT holders who curate our guest lineup each season. To get involved, head over to our website at rehashweb3.xyz and collect this episode as an NFT. Anyone who collects an episode becomes a part of Rehash DAO and will be able to nominate guests for future seasons. Voting rights are reserved for our guests, sponsors, and OG crowdfund supporters. And to learn more about how to become a guest or sponsor, go to rehashweb3.xyz/podcast. Finally, be sure to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok at rehashweb3 or on Lens at rehash.lens.